Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information, security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by BugCrowd, the security industry's clear leader in outsourced bug bounties. More information on them at bugcrowd.com. And this week's show is one for the CSOs. It's the economics edition, I guess you'd call it. We'll be chatting with Professor Lawrence Gordon. He is the co-creator of the Gordon Loeb model for cybersecurity investment. We'll be speaking to him about contemporary InfoSec budgets and how spending of $500 million a year by some financial institutions in the USA, that's their security spending, we'll be talking about how that can actually be sensible. That's this week's feature interview. We're sticking with the economics theme in this week's sponsor interview. We'll be chatting with Jonathan Cran, who is the VP of Operations for BugCrowd. And we'll be talking to him about BugCrowd's recently released document, the Defensive Vulnerability Pricing Model. They've also released their vulnerability rating taxonomy. Both of these documents are really, really interesting. So do stay tuned for this week's sponsor interview to hear all about them, with big thanks to BugCrowd. But before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, we begin the week's news with a blast from the past, kinda. Some 90s hacking lulls, courtesy of our good friends at Cisco.
Yep. So Cisco's ASA firewalls, you may have heard of them, terminate, amongst other things, VPNs on them. They filter packets, they terminate VPNs, they do a bunch of, you know, important network security perimeter things from the 90s that are still very important these days, allegedly.
Timeless, timeless things.
Timeless packet filtering and VPN termination. Anyway, Exodus Intel dropped a blog post this morning to go along with a bug that they have reported to Cisco, which appears to be remote heap overflow leading to remote code execution in Cisco's Ike daemon on the Cisco ASA firewall. The Ike is part of IPsec setup. It's the key exchange portion and like initial connection setup part of IPsec. So if you've got an IPsec VPN endpoint on the internet using Cisco ASA, it sounds like you're going to have a bad time.
Yeah,
Exodus have done a really thorough blog post going through the actual bug primitive and then the methods by which they turn it into code exec, which is not actually a super straightforward process. They haven't dropped an exploit yet, but there's certainly plenty of detail in there.
And HD Moore is unemployed and has time on his hands, right? So yeah. I'd say we'll be seeing one presently.
Yeah, I know HD tweeted this morning, have just bought a Cisco ASA 5500. Good times ahead.
That's right.
Yes, good times for him, bad times for Cisco and everybody else who has an ASA. And of course, I mean, everyone's ASAs are super widely deployed. And of course, the other problem is to get updated firmware for them, you've got to have support contracts with Cisco and they're very expensive. And, you know, a lot of people have end of life ASAs that are out of support or they don't have support contracts for them. And that's just the reality of it. And for those people, you're pretty much screwed, right? Once an exploit for this hits the open internet.
A saving grace here is that, you know, I'm imagining IPsec is usually used these days as site to site. I can't imagine people doing it for many endpoints. So would you be able to IP restrict the incoming data to that daemon so that, you know, no one can exploit it unless they're at your other site?
Yes, I mean, you can. I mean, that would be certainly good advice to do. Use it for site-to-site VPNs, not use it for what they used to quaintly term road warrior VPNs
when you had a dynamic endpoint.
But, you know, the sort of the interaction between IPsec and packet filtering can be quite complicated depending on how the kernel or how the IP stack processes it.
Yeah, cannot NAT, et cetera.
Yeah, there's all sorts of, you know, sort of nuances, I guess, in packet filtering stuff that's related to VPN traffic. You know, sometimes you end up with a rule that says allow anything that comes in a VPN, and that somehow magically includes the VPN kind of control traffic, so the Ike. So anyway, there are some complexities that you might want to test if you are going to rely on merely packet filtering the endpoints. Of course, Ike is also UDP, so, you know, you can spoof it if you know where it's coming from. I'm not sure how much Ike chit-chat you have to do to actually set up the bug, whether it's a single packet one or not. If it's single packet, obviously it's going to be easier to spoof than if there's chit chat involved. Either way, remote code exec in Cisco, I say security products is not really what you're looking for when you buy one.
Now, there's been a bunch of stuff happening in Washington, D.C. Obama has released this, national cybersecurity strategy thing. A listener based in D.C. very kindly cut and pasted the White House press release to me, so thank you for that. You know who you are. And, it's the Cybersecurity National Action Plan, and, ours has taken the angle on this piece that Obama wants you to join the Cyber Corps Reserve.
Yeah, this is an interesting program that they're proposing. Obviously, there's a number of problems with the security of the American government computer apparatus. We only have to look as far as the Office of Personnel Management success to see how that's going for them. So there's a lot of problems they've got, obviously, and this is an inferior project to add something like $19 billion worth of extra rubbish security appliances and threat intelligence services to fix something very, very well, I'm sure. One of the bits that does stand out that ours is mentioning in the title is this education fund, where they will provide government funding for you to go and do tertiary education if you then go on and work for the federal government in a cyber capacity, which that is actually a useful thing. Although the thing that really made me laugh about this particular story is this bit. Apparently Obama did an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about this, and he said the example of the Social Security Administration, which, quote, uses systems and code from the 1960s, no successful business could operate this way, end quote. Has anyone looked at a bank lately?
Yeah, exactly.
Or an airline or rented a car and got the printouts on the dot matrix?
They're practically still on reel-to-reel tape and punch cards at some of the banks, I remember my dad did COBOL programming in the 60s. He was a mathematician, and during the whole Y2K frenzy, I'm like, he was retired by that point. I'm like, no, go, charge him $500 an hour. Do it, because there was not many people left who could actually do stuff with COBOL.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly I think he may have to reevaluate that particular stance on the 1960s private sector as a comparison, because it's absolutely how it works.
Turning our attention to Russia now, and some police raids in Moscow could signal the end of the dire bank Trojan.
Yeah, so Reuters is reporting apparently a police raid in Moscow on what appears to be the gang behind Dire, according to some of the sources, which is one of the really big banking malware Trojans that we've seen. Something like 24% of the banking fraud that's as a result of it apparently is attributed to the Dire botnet. So it really is one of the big ones. And if you've seen some of the big spam campaigns in your mailbox over the last 6 months to a year, a lot of that is that kind of invoice fraudy stuff with the stuff with fake invoices. A lot of that has been Dire, so it's been pulling in some fairly serious money. And it sounds like the FSB have rolled in and made some I was gonna say arrests. I don't know if the FSB so much arrest you as drag you away, but
never to be seen again. Holiday with the journalists.
Yeah, so it'll be it'll be interesting to see when we get some more information, whether that is what's happening. Because sometimes these crime gangs do go quiet of their own accord. I mean, the Carbanic gang disappeared for a little while, regrouped and then came back with new gusto. So, it may not actually be what's going on, but I mean, clearly the sources are suggesting that may be the end of the Dire case. And of course, that's quite a significant one, because we haven't seen much cooperation, with Western law enforcement on this kind of cybercrime with the Russians.
Yeah, they forgot to pay their bribes. They scheduled the payment, but the thing bounced, and next thing you know, the FSB's knocking down the door. What was the other one? What was the Trojan that was the go-to for financial fraud for years? What was it called?
There was the Zeus one, which is the same guy, right?
Oh,
same
is
guy
it? As, right, as okay, behind, okay.
Dire, allegedly.
Yeah, okay. Right. Those guys, I mean, come on, man. Like, if you can't have made some serious retirement cash by now, just give it up.
Yeah, and maybe this is them, making their exit in a way that looks like they've been taken out and sent off for hard labor, when in fact, they're eating caviar on the Black Sea.
There you go. Of all places to eat caviar, the Black Sea, very appropriate. I like it. Drydex, staying with malware now, and this is funny. This is actually super funny. There's a network that was distributing Drydex, which has all of a sudden started distributing AV programs. And the going theory is, I think it was like Avast or something. No, Avira. So someone from Avira has owned up their distro networks and has started distributing free copies of AV, which I think is hilarious.
Which is pretty funny, yeah. I mean, the idea that some white hat would do that for the lols is quite appealing. I mean, the alternative option perhps is that the Drydex gang were going to use Avira to disinfect the machines that they were infecting before they infected themselves, so as to get rid of other competing botnets and just kind of screwed it up, which is another thing that could have happened. But yeah, the White Hat dropping AV on people, that's pretty funny.
Some strange goings on the old internet, you would say. Ah, here's a bit of news that would do Barnaby Jack proud. Adam.
Yeah, so another thing from the Kaspersky conference is a piece of malware that is designed for deployment on bank internal networks, which has the ability, amongst other things, to roll back ATM transactions, which, like, that's pretty cool. So the idea is that, yeah, you own the bank, you drop it in the appropriate place on the network, and then you send your money mule out to the ATM, they put the card in, they take the cash out, they put the card in, they take the cash out, they put the card in, they take the cash out, until the machine runs out of money. And every time you put the card in, take the cash out, it just rolls the transaction back.
Yeah,
which is a beautiful thing, and apparently, like, I mean, this sounds, as you say, like a Barnes lulls on stage kind of trick. But apparently, some bank in Russia lost millions of rubles overnight.
Yeah.
To this particular scam, which it's pretty cool. Like, I always loved that that scene in Terminator 2 where John Connor puts his, you know, Atari portable Atari into the ATM and makes money come out. Like, this is as good as it gets.
Yeah, look, it is, and you got to imagine that this is going to be a pretty catastrophic problem for some of the smaller players in the third-party ATM business. Do you know what I mean? Because I know people in that business, and they are not security-conscious people. They buy the ATMs, they cut a deal with, you know, wherever they're putting them, whether it's a pub, a 7-Eleven, you know, whatever it is. They cut a deal, they put the thing in there, they split the transaction fees, whatever. You know, these are guys who go around emptying out these, or filling these machines. They just go to the bank, pick up a huge pile of cash, and then just go around filling the machines, la-di-da-di-da, you know, no security at all. I think it's a matter of time before we see a couple of these players get taken down.
Yeah, I absolutely expect so. I mean, clearly the level of sophistication and the willingness to kind of invest the necessary time to worm your way into the organization and find the right place and to develop the tools necessary. I mean, this kind of rolling a transaction back is not a, you know, thing that's going to work everywhere. You have to kind of customize it for each particular transaction processing system that you're in. I mean, this is, you know, evidence that it's worth going to that effort. And as you say, those smaller players are ripe for the picking.
Yeah, maybe not so much with those network-based attacks, but yeah, in terms of there being an existential threat, definitely. Krebs has also got an interesting write-up here about ATMs. There's some people are inserting like devices between the network socket and the ATM, but I'm not exactly clear on what the article is saying that these devices are doing.
Yeah, well, according to Krebs, is asserting that people are man-in-the-middling the network connections upstream of, you know, those kind of rubbish, you know, convenience store-grade ATMs that have exposed network cabling that, you know, aren't plumbed into the wall well, and then skimming the card details off the wire, you know, in combination with a camera to get the pin pad, rather than skimming them, you know, on the card swipe slot, you know, where these days it's a little more obvious to people because they have those little, you know, plastic sleeve things. Mm. You would hope, of course, that the network communications on the back end of an ATM are not in the clear.
You would hope. However,
however, the fact that they are doing it suggests that no, they are not consistently encrypted everywhere. And yet, certainly, if you've looked at ATM networks, I mean, the, you know, pervasive encryption everywhere is not the state of the world, shall we say. So yeah, this is, you know, makes sense as an attacker. Of course, doing it right next to the ATM where people are going to look perhaps isn't the best move, but of course you could do this anywhere further upstream as well, in the wiring cabinet, you know, or on the network further upstream.
A malware museum has sprung up online with the best, you know, DOS viruses of the 90s and 80s. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is great. The more great work from archive.org, from Jason Scott, and in this case also Mikko Hipponen. They've got together and taken Mikko's collection of kind of old defanged DOS viruses that have some kind of, you know, sort of entertainment value, and stuck them up on archive.org, which already had a JavaScript-based DOS emulator for playing the DOS games collection on archive.org, which I might add is a great way to while away the afternoon if you don't.
I can play Alley Cat this afternoon?
You can play Alley Cat in a browser. I have done exactly that when I was you know, probably meant to be doing something else. But no, so using that engine to run old DOS viruses is a natural and relatively straightforward progression. And yeah, there's about 70 or 80 viruses currently available. Most of them are in kind of a sort of a defanged format where they demo their capability without actually propagating. So I mean, even though it's in a virtual machine, people still get kind of, you know, hinky about it for some reason.
I know. I read that where they're like, oh, they defanged them. And I'm like, well, unless you're running DOS, you know, it's probably not a problem. moving on now to this piece from the BBC, and apparently parents are being urged to boycott VTech. This is the huge toy maker that got owned, you know, with all this data on children and stuff. It made the news big time. I'm sure everyone remembers that. But apparently, yes, there is a boycott in the works against VTech.
Yeah, and apparently they've obviously got their act together and decided they're going to do something about their cybersecurity problems after their big breach, and they've solved it, which is amazing. They've come up with a scheme whereby they've updated the terms and conditions to just say, hey, look, if you use our stuff and give us your data, your problem if we lose it. Sorry. Accept yeah. or do not accept, and thus solving the problem, which of course has resulted in outcry and lots of wailing and gnashing of teeth, and people urging a boycott, and lots of cybersecurity policy people saying that this is not a reasonable thing to do, which I think probably isn't a reasonable thing to do. if we quote briefly from their terms and conditions, it says, you acknowledge and agree that any information you send or receive during your use of the site may not be secure and may be intercepted or later acquired by unauthorized parties. You acknowledge and agree that your use of the site or any software or firmware downloaded is therefore at your own risk.
Which, haha, see, we fixed it.
in their defense, at least it's honest.
True. At least it's honest. And there's probably a whole bunch of lawyers who said, you know, in order for you to keep doing business, this is what it has to be. So, you know, we'll just, look, I'd be surprised if this actually influenced the purchasing decisions of parents. But anyway, Register reports that Google is ordering almost all ads that appear on its network to adopt HTML5. This means that, you know, the internet is becoming a much friendlier place for browsers that do not have Flash. And I recently discovered that because I bought a new laptop this week. And sure enough, you know, plugged it in without Flash and I'm like, oh, everything works now. The last time I did that probably would have been a year or two ago and it was a different experience. So this is, it really does look like Flash plugin is going.
Yeah, it is clearly on the down and out. And if even Google are willing to, turn away advertising that has Flash components in it, then, you know, clearly it must be a relatively small bit of the pie by now, which is a great thing. They're saying they're not going to accept ads that contain Flash from June this year, and they're just going to stop working come January next year. So I guess we have to wait another year for that to finally go away. Apparently they're keeping them for some video advertising or something.
This is the problem, right? This is why Flash won't go and die a complete death for some time to come, is because, you know, simply put, there are some things that Flash can do that HTML5 can't do or can't do reliably, right? So, you know, there's going to be that long tail where that's going to drag it out for a while. But I would say, yeah, we might actually see a bit of a Flash death spiral in a year. As people move to new boxes and new installations of our operating systems, they just won't be compelled to install it because they won't see missing content.
Yeah, and that would be a wonderful thing. I mean, certainly anywhere we go from the 90-whatever% penetration they had previously, you know, that's an improvement.
Mm. A piece here from Wired by Kim Zetter saying that, it's possible to do funny things to the power grid by messing with the controllers that power companies give to some of their customers. They give you a discount, basically, if you agree to have this thing installed in your house that will cut your air conditioning at, like, really high peak times and things like that. Apparently, you can set up a big-ass antenna, tell them all to turn on or off, and they'll just do it because there's no auth or anything. It's an interesting look at IoT.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely classic SCADA, SCADA 101, remote control of devices via radio with no auth or integrity or anything whatsoever, and you plug it into a big system like the power grid, and then you get surprised when it turns out that perhaps you could do bad things with it. And, I mean, the example of using it for air conditioners is certainly one. There's plenty of other things. I mean, certainly here in New Zealand, you get a discount for having your hot water cylinder hooked up to a system that lets them power cycle it remotely or provide power during off-peak times. So, I mean, this kind of technology is all over the place. But yeah, it's just, this is unfortunately how, when you roll out systems, well, certainly how you rolled out power systems in the 90s, this was how you did it. But yeah, this is what we have come to expect from SCADA. Actually, I know this is another piece from the Kaspersky conference, isn't it? They've done a bunch of interesting stuff.
From Tenerife in Spain, and I got some friends who are there posting, some pretty awesome pictures on Facebook. I'm kind of jelly, actually. It looks like a blast, so hello to everyone who was over there. Julian Assange, meanwhile, the United Nations has ruled that he's been arbitrarily detained and that Sweden and the UK are interfering with his right to asylum, blah, blah, blah. Like, let's not get into it too much. But what is interesting, though, is there's been a little bit of movement here in Australia. The foreign minister has indicated that she might actually go into bat for him. And I think this has a lot to do with the fact that the Australian government is seeking a seat on the United Nations Human Rights Council. So there is all of a sudden a little bit of political support for him here that did not exist previously.
That is an interesting kind of interesting twist to it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's not an angle that most of the press has actually picked up on yet. But that is what's going on. There is now political motivation. So I'm just flagging it as something to keep an eye on because I reckon we could see some movement with Assange this year, which would be interesting. I suppose it's about time.
Well, really.
Gmail is about to warn you when you receive email from an SMTP box that isn't rolling TLS, which is interesting. Sign of the times, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good. It's a good development, and it's really cool to see Google, you know, continuing to push and innovate, in security, especially around SMTLS. I mean, that's a thing that they've done a lot of work to increase the adoption of. And I'm torn because, of course, having a little padlock on the mail is going to make people think it's better than it is. SMTP for mail transport, you know, really is a transport crypto only, opportunistic with no endpoint identification or anything.
No, it's easy to man in the middle, but it does address massive passive archives that the NSA are going to use to blackmail you with 30 years later, you know?
Exactly right. And that's the core point, right, is that we are arriving in a world where passive intercept is dying, and this, you know, doing it for mail, having universal HTTPS everywhere, between mail being transported and encrypted on the wire with SMTP TLS and universal SSL for websites and, you know, let's encrypt, all that kind of thing. You know, we really are in the process of killing passive intercept, and that's a worthwhile goal. And that's one of the things that, I think Snowden will have as his legacy. So, you know, a little padlock in the mail is a good step along the way towards that, even though, of course, it doesn't address a bunch of the other problems with mail crypto as a larger, you know, as a larger thing.
There have been some sort of engineering changes to Chrome on Windows 10, which look pretty good. Anyone who's interested in that can click through in this week's show notes and have a bit of a read of what they've done. But, you know, it's definitely the go-to browser, Chrome, when it comes to actually, you know, not getting owned on the internet.
And it's also a really great example of Google pushing the state of the art in the operating systems as well. I mean, some of these things that have been added to Chrome here are the result of Google finding, you know, kind of shortcomings in the Windows sandboxing infrastructure and then getting Microsoft to fix them and then everyone improving as a result. So it's a really good kind of collaboration.
It is. Another great piece here, which, you know, we don't really have time to discuss in too much detail, but there's been a lot of controversy at the University of California, Berkeley, where a whole bunch of full packet capture, you know, boxes got wheeled into the university and the students are freaking out going, hang on, you can't roll full packet capture on this, on this network. That's a violation of our privacy. And the conversation that's happening there is just a smaller version of the bigger conversation around interception, which is why I think this is a piece worth reading, you know. You know what I mean by that, don't you?
Yeah, you know, it is. It's sort of in miniature with on all sides. And, of course, it is subject to the same outcome, which is that passive intercept is stopping being a thing and all of this money will be spent badly on the wrong things. But, yeah, that is the debate in miniature.
You got the university team saying, but security, and the students saying, but privacy. And it's all just, you know, it's very quaint. Pwned to Own is back in 2016. VMware is the number one target, VMware Workstation. Everyone's looking for a VMware Workstation escape. That's worth 13 points this year. Google Chrome is only worth 10. That's interesting.
Yeah, so they're running the Windows-based browsers that you can exploit in Pwned to Own inside VMware, and then you get an extra, you know, whatever it is, $70,000 if you manage to pop, the browser and then pop out of the VMware. So that's pretty cool. It's first time we've seen virtualization show up in Pwned to Own. It'll be funny to see who shows up and cashes out.
Last week we discussed the bug in SOCAT, which was the non-prime prime, which was quite funny. You sent me a link to a very interesting write-up on how you can actually go about exploiting that.
Yeah, and man, there is a lot of crypto words in there. And if you like crypto and math, it will be a very interesting and informative read. For everybody else, it's just sort of
Lot of characters on a white space for me.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. If you just want to read it and understand things you don't know, then I would highly recommend it for that purpose.
All right. Well, Adam, that's it for the week's news, mate. Thank you very much for joining us and for sending me that indecipherable link. Really do appreciate it. And we'll chat to you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It is time for this week's feature interview now with Professor Lawrence Gordon, a Professor of Managerial Accounting and Information Assurance with the University of Maryland's Smith School of Business. His work focuses on the issues of performance measures, economic aspects of information security, cost management systems, the interface between managerial accounting and information technology, and capital investments. Dr. Gordon is considered to be one of the pioneers on the emerging field of cybersecurity economics. He co-created the Gordon Loeb model for cybersecurity, which was first published, I believe, in 2002. But it was in a lot of ways ahead of its time. His model argues that you get diminishing returns for every dollar you add to an information security budget. So while some organizations throw all of their InfoSec money at securing their most valued data, Professor Gordon says they should be spreading their budget out to protect less critical data sets in order to get the most bang for their buck. He also says information security spending should be roughly equivalent to 37% of the possible loss from a breach. As you'll hear, however, economic models aren't necessarily precise, and Dr. Gordon is the first to admit they're no substitute for good business decisions. I spoke with Dr. Gordon via phone earlier this week, and I'll warn you now, a couple of his earlier answers are pretty long, but do bear with this interview. Here he is.
Contrary to what a lot of people think, okay, you don't want to keep investing, okay, up to the point where the level of investment is equal to, you know, the sort of the average savings. It's really it's the marginal savings. It's increasing returns to it, but it's increasing at a decreasing rate. So the real takeaway is that you want to invest. Okay, a lot less than a lot of people tend to think. If you go back and look at a lot of this literature in the area, what they did was they kept talking as if, you know, if you think you could lose up to $10 million, that you might want to invest up to $10 million. That's not true, because your first $2 million, you might get most of the benefits. From the next $8 million, or for the first four million, you're probably going to get most of your benefits. For the next $6 million, you're already the marginal benefits are less than the cost.
So what then do you make of organizations in the United States, like some of the major banks, who are saying they have uncapped security budgets and will probably spend in the order of $500 million per annum on security?
The truth is, they could easily lose $1 to $2 billion in terms of, you know, the real economic loss could be $1 to $2 billion. And the reason for that is they're losing sales, they've got potential liability. You know, all these studies that you're looking at, where they give you a number of how much the cost of these breaches are, for the most part, what they're giving you is the cost of a breach in terms of the cost to detect the breach and to correct the breach. They rarely estimate the potential effect to your brand name or your customer, you know, lost customers and potential liability. So, in fact, one of the reasons why cybersecurity insurance, okay, has been slow to gain acceptance, although it is slowly gaining real acceptance in the U.S., okay, one of the reasons is that they haven't been able to get enough insurance. The ceilings have been too low. Companies want $1 billion or $2 billion, really. What companies really need is $1 billion or $2 billion. So if a big company is investing $300-400 million in cybersecurity, okay, their potential loss could be in the billions. Let me give you an example. Take Target. Are you familiar with the Target Corporation?
Yes, of course, yes.
That they had in 2013 in the U.S.? Okay, so Target's one that got a lot of attention in the U.S., right? And what makes Target a good one to talk about is, because of their big breach and because of the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, okay, the Securities Exchange Commission has what they call a disclosure guidance on what you should be doing in terms of reporting your security, cybersecurity risk and your cyber incidences. You can go to their annual report. What you'll find in their annual report for the year of 2013, when they had this big breach, is they talk about the potential cost of this breach, all right? And they talk about the cost of breach being around 140, I think it was 148 million, something like that, and they had cybersecurity insurance up to some point. But then as you go into the next year and all, the number keeps getting larger and larger. But what they've never really done is they say in their annual report that we realize this affected our sales, but they never really try to estimate the effect on the sales, right? They also say in that annual report, if you go to 2013, they also talk about the potential liability, but they never really try to estimate the potential liability. That $148 million that they're giving you is a very conservative number. There's absolutely no question about that, okay? What makes Target so interesting is the following. Take a look at their annual report, the 10-K report. Are you familiar with what the SEC calls the 10-K report? Okay, so if you take a look at their 10-K report for the year before, they have one paragraph on cybersecurity risk that, of course, that's a potential issue and that we're concerned about it, but we've had nothing significant happen to us. If you go to the 2013 10-K report, you find that they have all through the report a total of about 7 full pages where they discuss it, but they don't really come up with estimates of the lost sales or the potential liability. So here's the facts. In 2012, Target's income was roughly $3 billion. Net income was roughly $3 billion. In 2013, their net income was roughly, I believe, $2 billion. But their sales were roughly the same, very slight change. So where's that other $1 billion? Well, it's not only due to the cybersecurity breach. They also had a very poor investment in Canada, and they had to close down a bunch of stores. So what I like to tell my students, and this is what I do, I cover this in my class, is I say, so let's just say only half of that lost in income was due to the breach. That's $500 million. We don't know the exact number. But what I'm trying to say to you is that the potential loss to these companies is way beyond what they're investing, and they realize that. So a lot of these companies, implicitly are realizing.
One thing I'm curious about, Larry, is that your model asks, people who use it to estimate the risk of something being, or the likelihood of something being breached. Isn't that kind of a difficult probability or metric to determine? I mean, how do you recommend that people go about doing that? Because, as we know, different types of attacks are emerging all of the time, different types of groups who go for different types of information. So how are you expected to pull out this seemingly, impossible to ascertain number?
I don't have a magic formula for that. I can only tell you that there are different techniques for trying to come up with that. One of the techniques that I personally like would be using something like an analytical hierarchy of process. It's called AHP. You could, get a group of senior executives who have real experience, and it would vary from company to company. There's no, every company is going to be different. They have to, that's an estimate they have to come up with. We've written papers on how they can go about trying to estimate it. In fact, we have a paper that we wrote, it was published in the Communications of the ACM, where we argued for using a composite measure of risk, using AHP. But you're absolutely correct. I mean, there's no simple way to come up with it. That's one reason why I would never take the formula and go into a bunch of companies. I don't know those companies that well. The executives in the company know their companies. They've got to estimate this. They've also got to estimate the value of their information.
This is something that I wanted to really question you on, right? Because in a lot of these models, what they're asking people to do is estimate the value of the information to them. Whereas I think a much more important way to measure the value of information is to look at how valuable it is to someone who acts outside of the law. So look at how valuable it is to a group who's conducting fraud. Look at how valuable it is to a group conducting espionage or IP theft. I mean, isn't that a metric that you have to use in these calculations? So I just wonder if sometimes people miss that step.
Well, you're absolutely right. Our model does not take that in consideration. I think you're absolutely on target. That would be an extension of the model to try to figure that out. What we've done is we've extended the model to try to exclude externalities in recent, actually a year ago, it was published in the Journal of Information Security. But what you're really suggesting is when you're going to try to come up with how much to invest, what is it worth to someone else? But from my point of view, if I'm a private company, my main concern is what do I lose, not how much you're saying, how much do you gain rather than what do I lose?
How much does the attacker gain? Yeah, because that really impacts the likelihood of a breach, right?
I think the way to handle what you're suggesting, okay, just generically, I don't have numbers for you, but would be that really affects the probability of a breach, right? That really affects your motivation to breach my information set. So what, if I understood you correctly, I agree completely with you, and it's really a good point. That should be factored into the probability, okay, of a breach, or, you know, the vulnerability of the information. Because the more valuable that information is to someone outside, the more likely they're going to work hard to breach my information, right? That's a great point. It's a wonderful point. Actually, I haven't seen anything written specifically or incorporating that factor into the probability of the breach itself.
Well, I mean, it seems to almost directly correlate with, you know, likelihood. Basically, is the, you know, not the value to the organization, but to the actual attackers. But I wanted to ask you too, whether you know of your model being used to determine budgets in large organizations. Is this something CISOs are using yet?
So we know of a lot of companies that have claimed to be trying to use the general idea. There was an article written by some guys at the University of Tokyo where they were trying to apply it to the government of Tokyo and some specific database they were using. But again, the problem is this. I get asked over and over all the time, okay, in principle, we agree with what you're saying. How can I use it? Okay, and that's why the video tried to get at how to use it. And the answer is that lots of people have told me they've tried, in government agencies, have told me they've tried to use the concepts. They generally agree, but they come back to a lot of the same questions you're asking. How do we come up with the probability? How do we come up with the value of the information? How do we come up with the productivity functions of the investment? Those are the three. And my answer is always the same. It's your organization. You've got to estimate that. I'm a believer in that economic models don't replace good, sound business judgment. So that whenever I give a presentation, you might appreciate this, okay, even when I give it to an academic audience, but especially when I give it to a non-academic audience, on my slides, I have a big, bold footnote, and I mean really large, saying economic models, okay, should be thought of as a complement to, not as a substitute for, sound business judgment. In other words, these models, any economic model like this, gives you sort of the framework for how to approach it, but you have to come up with, you know, how to come up with actual numbers. The best analogy I can give you, I don't know what your background is, but are you familiar with net present value models?
No, I can't say I am.
Okay, so they're what they call in finance and economics and accounting is we have these net present value models. And they started getting to become well-known, I would say, in the early 60s. And when they first came out, everyone was saying, well, you can't use it because these are all estimates of cash flows and they're estimates of discount rates. Today, almost every major corporation uses them, but they use them as a complement to, not as a substitute for, sound business judgment. And that's really how our model should be used.
Your model is a way of illustrating a way that you can use the knowledge of diminishing returns on spending in security to reprioritize and retarget some spending and basically get the most out of your security budget.
Right. And it also, good way of putting it, it gives you a logical framework on how to approach the problem, okay? And if you wanted to, you could throw in different numbers and do what we call a sensitivity analysis to get a handle on it. But when you get finished, it's based on all these estimates, okay? And you can't just take the model, get a number, and apply that number as if you're going to have the right answer. But that's exactly how firms use net present value models, okay? So our model is, the way I like to think of it, rather than thinking of it as a model, even though it is a model, it's a framework for a process of going through determining how much you want to invest in protecting your information.
That's all fascinating stuff. Larry Gordon, thank you very much for joining us on the program to discuss this economic model around budgeting for security programs.
Patrick, I really appreciate your interest. I do appreciate it.
That was Professor Lawrence Gordon, who insisted I called him Larry and did invite me to drop by for lunch if I was ever in the DC area. He's a really nice guy, a very smart guy as well, as you can no doubt tell. And thanks to Tenable CEO Ron Gula, who suggested this interview the last time we spoke, and he actually brokered an introduction. So thanks, Ron. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Jay Cran, Jonathan Cran. He is the Vice President of Operations for this week's sponsor, BugCrowd. Now, I wholeheartedly endorse these guys, BugCrowd. I think they are the most switched-on company in the outsourced bug bounty space. The products and services they offer are, I believe, simply the best in the market. And I hate to use the term, but BugCrowd really is the thought leader in this space. In a way, its competitors just aren't. And occasionally they publish something like what we're discussing today, the Defensive Vulnerability Pricing Model, or the DVPM. Now, you need to register on their website to get a copy of it, but it's worth it. I have dropped a link into this week's show notes, so you can click through and get a copy. Now, regular listeners would have heard me speaking with BugCrowd CEO Casey Ellison, often asking him about how you do actually price bugs. Well, and he'd always give these sort of complicated answers, and it was kind of difficult to pin down. Well, this document sort of explains how that process works in pretty concrete detail. And what I found absolutely fascinating about it is the prices actually vary along with the maturity of the organization that's commissioning the bug bounty. So, I mean, you know, of course, they might vary with criticality as well, but identical bugs are worth different amounts in different bounties, not because of a factor like industry vertical or criticality, but on how advanced an organization's other security programs are, right? So it's really interesting stuff. Anyway, Jay Cran worked on this document and he joined me via Skype to discuss it and also to talk about BugCrowd's vulnerability rating taxonomy, another fabulous document that spells out how BugCrowd determines a vulnerability's priority in a bug bounty program. I started off by asking Jay Cran to tell us a bit about the Defensive Vulnerability Pricing Model. Here he is.
It's a document that we've been building inside BugCrowd for some time. And what it really tries to do is boil down pricing to the simplest thing that we possibly can. So we looked at what were the factors that affected folks who were running bug bounties. How did they think about what to pay for a bug and what a bug was worth? And it really boiled down to security maturity inside the organization and the priority of the submission as it came across and as a vulnerability was rated. And so, you know, it basically tries to put folks into a category of beginner, advanced, or progressive, and then goes and looks at what ranges people should be paying in order to attract the talent that's going to keep them engaged on the program.
Well, yeah, and this is something that I found interesting about it is, you know, what a bug is worth depends on who's buying it.
That's exactly right.
Which, you know, in retrospect makes total sense, but it is not immediately obvious that that would be the case. You would think, so while it is obvious that, you know, a cross-site scripting bug in a online pet food company wouldn't be worth as much to, you know, like a bank, you know, that has the exact same cross-site scripting bug. What you guys seem to be saying, though, is it's not even just the type of organization that sets the context and the price, but it's also the maturity of the organization. So there might be some really large online pet store company where they are going to pay more for a cross-site scripting bug than some regional bank in, you know, bum nowhere, right?
So that's right.
A lot of it is more about the organizational model rather than the criticality of the bug. It's interesting.
Yeah, and if you really wanted to boil it down into individual assets, you know, you're going to pay more for your financial processing systems than you would for your whatever marketing systems that you don't control, and you may not even, you know, have any ability to change, right? Getting it down to an idea of your maturity really gives you a sense of what the asset and what the asset's been through in terms of testing. And so if there's something that has been tested a bunch, it's going to be harder to find things on. And most of these progressive organizations or advanced organizations have already done some testing on their assets before they hit the internet. And so they're really trying to attract the best of the best researchers. And in order to do that, and when you boil it down to that, it's all about competing for the best resources that can give you what you're in need of, which is better testing or a deeper look into how the application works or that sort of thing. And there's a finite set of very good researchers out there, and making sure that you're competitive for talent when doing a bug bounty is really important. We find that a lot of our customers come to us and say, we don't know what we should pay in order to compete for talent. You know, can you guide us? And that's really where the idea of this came from.
Now, as you said before, too, there is, the nature of the vulnerability also factors into what people should be or what people do wind up paying for it. And that's why you've released this vulnerability rating taxonomy, which is a very straightforward document. It's a table which really gives you indications of priority and worth of these bugs, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This was a project that was driven inside BugCrowd. Jason Haddix, who runs our technical operations team, really drove this one to completion and got it out. It is designed to help folks who are new to running a bug bounty understand what the norm is in terms of paying for a specific bug or what the priority of a bug should be thought of. And we find that so often BugCrowd sits in the middle of a communication stream between a researcher and an organization, and we do our best to align expectations. And that's really where the value of a provider comes in, helping you ensure that you're both communicating about the same thing, you both have the same expectations, and that you are actively competing for talent and getting value on both sides.
Yeah, and you've got like priority one through to priority five, priority one being the most serious, and then you've got, a little bit of context around them and whatnot. I would imagine, though, that this was something that you guys would have been using internally to submissions, right? Yeah, so, when I saw this, I thought, gee, this is actually kind of, this is BugCrowd intellectual property that you guys have decided to sort of release. Why is that?
We felt like now was the right time to help get the word out in terms of how we actually did our bug bounties and help people understand, what things were valuable on our organization. So it's valuable not only to researchers, but also to customers. Again, aligned expectations. And we find the more upfront work we do to align expectations, the smoother the program runs. For instance, if a program has a vulnerability taxonomy in the brief, we find that it's just generally smoother in the sense that, a researcher knows what he's going to be paid if he finds a SQL injection, for instance. There's no ambiguity, and it really boils down to him delivering that and then getting the payout, right? It's very simple. It's transactional. If you don't align expectations well, there can be disagreement over whether something's worth more or less.
Now, we've heard from Lawrence Gordon in this week's feature interview, talking about the Gordon Loeb cybersecurity model. Like, I understand you're familiar with the model. I mean, is there any way in which you've seen this model applied to, budgeting for bug bounties?
Yeah, so what we see with most of our customers is that they'll come in, and this is the first time they've run an external bug bounty, and where they find the most benefit right away is in the stuff that is relatively vulnerable. It's been out there. It hasn't really been touched. It's never been reported to them, and we see a big bump in submissions over time. And, as the program grows, there are certain high priority or high impact features that they want looked at, so they'll end up putting more money toward those particular features to get more activity on them. But the initial big bump tends to be around clearing out a backlog of bugs sort of across the board.
And so you do get the most value out of the first dollars you spend.
It's a really interesting question, and I think it boils down to many individual factors at the organization itself. We certainly see a big bump in submissions coming in at the beginning and sort of vulnerabilities being found right away. And what we found with the best organizations is that they sustain activity on their programs by raising their rewards over time or by finding other ways to engage researchers, like giving them very specific things to work on. Or when they release a new feature, they message the researchers who have already been engaged. And that's something that BugCrowd does pretty proactively on its programs. We certainly work to keep the activity sustained over time.
So I guess the reason I ask is, say you've got a really critical app and then a slightly less critical app, do you want to, how do you determine the bounty pool split between those two? Because putting all of the money into the very critical one might not even make that much sense. It might make sense to do an even split. Do you have any guidance in that situation?
Yeah. So I would look at the, what's a bug's worth or the defensive vulnerability pricing model. That gives a good sense of how to split out. Based on what's been done to the asset in the past. But the way I'd kind of think about this is you should aim to at least maintain an average payout consistent with the level of testing that asset has had. So if it's, you know, if it's an asset that's just getting onto the internet, it hasn't really had any testing, you're going to pay less on average for the submission than you would for an asset which has been fully tested and vetted internally and now is just being pushed out to the internet. The way we kind of guide customers when they first start a program is to look at a reward range and start there. And if they start to see trailing off activity, to bump that reward range. So if you've got two assets and one of those is highly critical, you'd probably want to have a higher range on that to begin with, especially if you want to attract more activity to that.
So, I guess setting budgets with a bug bounty is a little bit different to setting, you know, testing budgets and things like that, because you're getting feedback, aren't you, throughout the program. You're getting feedback in a way that you don't normally get from other types of activity.
That's exactly right. And as you adjust based on the kind of activity that you want, you can actually get to a point where you've budgeted and capped your budget to a certain amount. I mean, a lot of people think, you know, Facebook writes a blank check, Google writes a blank check, I need to write a blank check. But what we find is that organizations are able to work to a budget, basically, in terms of how they budget for their bug bounty program by adjusting the range.
Okay, J-Cran, that was all very interesting stuff. I'm going to drop links to the Reg pages, because both these documents, you need to register to get them, don't you?
You actually don't have to register to get the vulnerability taxonomy. I think you have to register to get the DBPM.
Okay, well, I'll throw a link into this week's show notes and people can register there to grab it. But J-Cran, that's it, mate. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again sometime through 2016.
Thanks so much, Matt.
That was Jonathan Cran there with a chat about some recently released documents from BugCrowd. If you are an organization that regularly tests applications, there is no excuse. You absolutely should be investigating a bug bounty program and supplementing your testing with bounties, and BugCrowd are the people to speak to about that. You'll wind up saving money and you will get better results. That is just my two cents. And I am not obligated to say this as part of the sponsorship arrangement, I should point out. I just think these guys do a fantastic job. Well, that's it for this week's show. A big thanks again to BugCrowd for sponsoring, also to Adam Boileau, and of course, Professor Larry Gordon. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.